All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and it shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 16006, State v. Yokota. Arguing for the petitioner, William H. Jamison. Arguing for the respondent, Brian R. Vincent. Argument on the merits.
All right, I don't think Mr. Jamison's here. It's Mr. Enright, correct? Very well. So the record will reflect the appearance of Christian Enright on behalf of the petitioner. And Mr. Vincent, good morning to you as well. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Enright, I understand you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a light that goes on with 5 minutes to go. And Mr. Vincent, you'll get a five-minute warning as well. Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. May it please the Court. Deputy Public Defender Christian Enright for Eric Yokota, the petitioner in this case.
And be sure to speak into the mic.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We are asking the court to affirm the order of the circuit court, which dismissed counts six and eight of the amended felony information in this case. And I'd like to begin by discussing count six. That's theft in the second degree. And I would first like to clarify our position. It's not our position that it's impermissible to charge a theft offense under the continuing course of conduct theory. And we further acknowledge that under certain circumstances, if it's alleged properly, that should be an issue that goes to the jury or the finder of fact. But in this particular case, based on the way that the case was charged by the state, we believe that it was proper for the circuit court to dismiss, as a matter of law, counts six and eight. And basically, I acknowledge that the state has broad discretion in how they bring a case, how they charge a case in court. But in this case, they elected to charge five separate counts of forgery in the second degree, Class C felonies, and then aggregate the amounts that were stolen to reach the theft in the second degree charge. That's where we take issue. Each forgery is a separate and distinct crime. So our position is that each resulting theft is a separate and distinct crime.
You mean by virtue of the way they charged it?
By virtue of the way they charged it.
So your argument is basically they should have charged all the forgeries as one count in the same way that they charged the theft.
That would be an option. The other option would be to, if you're going to proceed under the continuing course of conduct theory, and you're alleging that there's one scheme, one plan, one intent, then there's one crime, then the forgeries would be part and parcel of the scheme to achieve that theft, so you wouldn't charge the forgery.
But you're saying that as a matter of law, forgery could be charged as a continuing offense, or would you say that given the structure, it could only be charged as individual offenses each time the document is uttered?
Given the structure of the forgery statute, I believe that you cannot charge it as a continuing offense.
It can or cannot?
Cannot, sir. Because reading the language of the forgery statute necessarily is complete once the document is uttered, once the transaction is complete.
So you'd say they charge forgery correctly in charging each individual count?
Yes, sir.
Why does that somehow limit their ability to charge theft in a different manner?
Because if the definition of a continuing course offense is that there is one plan, one scheme, therefore there is one crime, if you're going to charge five separate offenses, I think you're necessarily alleging that there were five corresponding offenses. In this case, the forgeries correspond to the five thefts from Mr. Kama's account.
Can I follow up with your theory that forgery, as a matter of law, cannot be a continuing offense? Let's change the facts a little bit. These five forgeries, apparently, although we don't even know, and maybe it's only because I don't know, but could all of the five checks, for example, have been signed on the same day, even though they were uttered on different days?
In theory, and because there, at the moment, is no case law governing this.
Okay, well, let's suppose that the person had walked into the bank and done all five of these forgeries on the same day. Would that be continuing?
I suppose that that would be an issue for the jury.
So it is. It's not by law. And in fact, one can take my facts and say, instead of it being five on one day, how about if they just went to on the same day to the same bank and went to five different tellers? Or even to the same teller?
I suppose, you know, using the analysis from State versus DeCoy, trying to figure out which crimes can and cannot be charged as continuing course crimes, that the plain language of the forgery statute would seem to indicate that they are necessarily isolated incidents.
What's the plain language that differs from that than, say, an assault incident where you could have two or three hits over its course of 10 or 15 minutes or a few hours? I'm not sure what I see in the plain language.
Well, if you compare it to the theft statute where you can point to deception or intent to deprive, which I think are clearly elements that can take the course of several days, weeks, months, or years. The forgery statute doesn't contain those words per se. So by contrast, unless there's very clear language that would manifest an intent to allow.
But the conduct encompassed by the forgery statute includes making, endorsing, uttering. You know, those are all separate acts that apparently all come together and comprise forgery. It doesn't look like it's, you know, the thing to compare it to, I suppose, is when the sexual offenses was one act constituted a crime. There's nothing like that in right. Forgery.
Following up on what Justice Pollack has asked, it is actually the act of uttering that is the act here, right, in terms of the forgery.
In terms of the forgery.
It's not the date the checks were actually presented to the tellers, right?
That's correct.
So what if all of these checks had been uttered consecutively at the same time, and there were just different presentations?
If I understand that would constitute a continuing...
Wouldn't that be a possible continuous course of conduct?
Yes, I suppose. The dates are less relevant when determining... while they are relevant, they're not a determining factor if you're looking at whether a crime could be charged under the continuing course theory. So theoretically, if the petitioner in this case had gone into the bank with five separate checks, it could be charged as one offense. I'm not sure what you would accomplish by that from the prosecutor's standpoint, because by its nature, it's still a Class C felony.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is, because the theft here was a forgery, you're saying that means that it can't be charged as a continuing theft, because the theft statute appears to contemplate that multiple thefts could be aggregated, explicitly so, correct? So your theory is that because what happened here, the theft occurred or was the means of accomplishing the theft was a forgery, that in that unique circumstance it cannot be aggregated? I'm trying to understand your argument.
Yeah, that is precisely the argument, that because the unique circumstances of this case, insofar as the five forgeries were charged and then aggregated to reach the higher degree of theft in the second degree, that circuit court, when looking at the way that the case was charged, determined that, you know, you've alleged, the state has alleged that there were five separate and distinct acts of forgery, therefore there would be five corresponding thefts.
And what if the charge, charge had not included counts 1 through 5? Would that change your analysis?
I'm sorry?
What if the defendant was not charged with the forgeries? Would that...
That would completely change the analysis.
Well, let's suppose this. What's interesting about this case is the posture it comes to us. There's five counts of forgery, which your client has pled guilty to. There's still two outstanding counts. Suppose the court was wrong. Suppose we conclude the court was wrong for dismissal. It seems to me that one of the interesting situations that result from this case is if we were to reinstate the theft charge, it would seem that, and your client was convicted, then the jury would have had to make a factual finding that they all occurred within one course. The difficulty I have is, how do those forgery counts continue to maintain their individuality. I mean, it would seem to me that the court would, even though you pled, I'm not so sure that that a conviction could stand. I think you folks could file a merger motion.
I believe that that's precisely what we would do if it were to go back there.
So, Mr. Enright, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but doesn't that suggest that the real test for continuing course is the one in Castro that requires a determination by the jury of whether there was one general intent?
I think absent the forgery charges in this case, it would absolutely be a determination for the jury. But that the wrinkle, if you will, is that the state elected to charge the 5 forgeries, and that sort of it would take it out of the hands of the fact finder at that point. Because
so if in this particular case the defendant said, they actually had evidence that the defendant said his intent was to commit a number of offenses in a manner that would avoid the aggregation of up to $720, your feeling is nonetheless, because of the way that the charges were brought for forgery, you could not aggregate the claims for theft?
You're suggesting that there was a confession, essentially.
Yeah.
I'm
just assuming something that I think might be implied from the evidence here. I mean, perhaps a jury could find that the defendant did intend a continuing course of conduct, but wanted to commit these offenses in a way that would avoid a felony.
I think then you would perhaps have to examine what Justice Pollack referred to, that perhaps a forgery could be charged as a continuing course crime.
Well, that may be so, or as Justice Pollack says, maybe a merger would be appropriate. But if you're suggesting that the Castro determination of whether there's one general intent applies, help me with Decoit. How do you analyze Decoit? Do you feel that that case was wrongly decided? You know, I mean, in Decoit, where there was a determination that as a matter of law, domestic violence offenses are separate and distinct and therefore cannot be part of a continuing course of conduct?
With all due respect, I would tend to agree with the dissent in that case, that perhaps you could charge abuses as a continuing course of conduct crime. I'll leave it.
Why does it matter that how the state charges count 1 to 5? In other words, we're supposed to look at and interpret whether counts 6 and 8 were properly charged and whether they can even get to the trier of fact or not. Why does it matter? Because what you told me is, if I understood correctly, if counts 1 through 5 were not included in the charging document, this would be a different case, and we'd be going to, we should have gone to a jury to figure out if there was a continuing course of conduct. Why is it that it matters that the charges, the forgery charges were charged as they were? Why should that affect us? Is it an estoppel argument or an omission of some kind? I'm trying to understand why that's legally relevant to, as a question of law, how we analyze this case.
You know, it's essentially, you can characterize it as a notice argument. Is the defendant defending against 5 separate incidents of forgery, or the entire scheme itself? It's somewhat counterintuitive and confusing to say that you've committed 5 separate offenses, but yet we're aggregating the total of your crime to reach this high.
How does that impact your notice of how to defend an offense? It's pretty clear, although the forgery statute, there are different ways of committing forgery: endorse, complete, falsely make, alter, or utter. There are different ways of doing that. It was pretty clear from the discovery, or from what we've seen, what he did. And then the aggregate, how does that impact notice?
Well, from a practical standpoint, you know, if we went to trial, if, say, for instance, one of the forgery counts fails, the defendant's acquitted, does that necessarily mean that he's acquitted of the theft and the identity theft? Because they're alleging this continuous course of conduct, all 5 incidents. or...
That's an argument, right? It's not a notice problem. It's a... Is it a notice problem? I mean, it seems like it's a good argument that for the jury.
Well, we see it as a notice issue as well.
In essence, it seems that, as Justice Nakayama said, I think the state can probably allege different theories. What is interesting about this case is perhaps the argument that while the initial charges may have been valid and the judge may have prematurely and should perhaps erred in dismissing those counts, what's interesting is once those counts were dismissed and you pled guilty, the case is in this really odd posture where, as a matter of law, you have pled guilty to separate incidents, and the state allowed you to plead guilty, waited until you plead guilty until I think these cases were appealed, and then we get this odd situation that you pled guilty to individual offenses, and there's guilty pleas, and the argument is the state wants to go to trial and say, hey, this is all one course of conduct. So we have these conflicting things that are outstanding that makes this case pretty unusual. It's almost like, although the judge was wrong in the first place, maybe now the judge is correct because you pled guilty.
I assume you don't think the judge was wrong in the first place, though.
I do not.
Okay. Why don't you just address the question of should this have gone to a jury? In other words, why not simply instruct the jury of the relevant tests and have them assess whether it was a continuing course of conduct or individual events, as opposed to the judge predetermining that?
Well, I would submit that, you know, perhaps at the moment there's some ambiguity. And while I could certainly concede that the state is allowed to charge cases as they see fit, they have broad discretion to do so. There was what I would characterize as, you know, creative charging in this case. You have you've broken the five forgeries into five separate felonies, aggregated those crimes to get to a higher theft limit, which necessarily triggers the higher identity theft, the Class B felony. So perhaps yes, sir.
Well, no, I was just going to comment. As you say, the charging is interesting because this is one course of conduct they're claiming, and as I counted, there's eight counts charged here. Five counts of forgery, a theft two count, a unlawful possession of confidential information, and identity theft. So we have eight counts. They ask for extended term on every single count, it looks like to me. And if you consecutive these things, it could have been a 100-year sentence, theoretically. I mean, we at least got. And it seems if this case had been charged today, it would have been a misdemeanor. It would have been a misdemeanor because they've upped the amount to $750. It just, the charging, as you say, is interesting.
And I think that touches on the greater issue here, which is, you know, if the definition of a continuing course offense is that there's one crime. If in fact these series of events amounts to one plan, one scheme, and according to State versus Kashko, then there is one offense. Then when you read that the defendant's been charged with eight different offenses, it sort of cuts against the definition of a continuing course crime. That's our position.
So it is kind of an estoppel argument?
I suppose. We didn't raise that, but. I was going to address count eight, the identity theft. I understand that it didn't get much attention from the opening brief, but I'm prepared to discuss it. The way that we read the identity theft statute is similar to the forgery statute. That does not seem to contain anything overtly or obviously that would allow identity theft to be charged as a continuing offense. I think that if you were going to charge five forgeries, then essentially the identity thefts are part and parcel, you know, a vehicle by which to achieve the theft. I don't know that it's proper to aggregate the defendant's intent, essentially, to use this mechanism to commit a theft. So I believe that's an issue perhaps the circuit court was considering. I know the findings were somewhat brief.
Anything further at this point?
No, thank you, sir.
All right, we'll hear from Mr. Benson. Thank you. Mr. Benson,
good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Enright makes an interesting argument. This fellow took checks, went to the bank on five separate days, cashed checks below a certain amount, and now he's facing 20 years. Is that the extended term? I'm sorry, was it the extended term from the class B?
Yeah, I don't think we ever, we file the extended term sentencing as a matter of practice because we have to, and otherwise later on in the proceedings, we can't ask for the extended term sentence. Sometimes we don't seek the extended term sentence. So I don't think he was really, well, he did in fact face the 20 years here. He faces the 10 years for the Class B felony, the ID theft 2, which is, I think, what we're really here for.
And you only get there if you have the felony, the second degree theft.
Yeah, aggregated.
You only get the second degree theft if you have.
Right, right.
I mean,
and then the second degree theft would merge into the identity theft 2, I think.
Right.
So, but.
And is he? 20 years?
Yeah, I don't think that we charged this to be piling on charges. We charged it because it's easier, if we charge different charges with different elements, it's easier to prove at trial if something goes wrong in one of them. Let's say that, you know, one of the tellers can't ID the defendant or, you know, some other reason, okay? We end up not being able to prove anything if we just chose one thing, so we choose a number of different ones. And I think as far as the sentencing goes, I think it really doesn't matter whether you're convicted of eight charges or just one charge. It's the judge is going to run them all concurrent anyway, I believe.
Well, you don't think it matters to the Hawaii Paroling Authority, and you don't think it matters when there's a second conviction, when the person may come through the system again and they're sitting there with eight convictions, and it doesn't matter on bail when bail is set?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how the Hawaii Paroling Authority views these kind of things, but as a practical matter, as far as the actual sentence that the circuit court meets out, it's usually all run concurrently, and it really doesn't matter whether there's five forgery counts or one theft two count.
Well, that argument works in reverse too. If it's all going to be concurrent, then why have four or five charges if the sentence is going to be the same?
I think that's. I think there's a good argument for a merger at the end. If these forgeries, if it appears from the jury's verdict on the theft two and the ID theft two, that it's a continuing course of conduct. I think there's maybe a good argument that at least all the forgery charges perhaps merge into one.
It's your position that the forgeries are, it's a continuing course of conduct kind of case.
It could be, yes.
I mean, that's what your brief specifically says, that this is from your opening brief, that because there's a reasonable inference that can be taken from the state's factual allegations that the individual forgeries were a series of acts set on foot by a single impulse of Yokota, it is still more than $300, a question of whether the individual forgeries were continuous conduct should be submitted to the trier of fact.
Yeah, I mean, forgeries have a different elements, and I think have to be treated differently than the theft, but I think that they could be merged, the forgeries could be merged into one another. I mean, you know, they're all the same. Forgeries is the Class C, regardless of how...
Forgeries could merge into one another when they occur at different times?
If it's all continuous, if the jury found that it was a continuous course of conduct...
So you could charge multiple forgeries as one count? I'm trying to understand what you're saying. So you're saying the counts 1 through 5 could have been charged as one count of forgery with five different executions or something?
I mean, our office, we charge it a forgery count for each check, okay, but... I think theoretically you could charge a series of discrete utterances of checks as a continuous course of conduct.
Actually, I'm not, you know, I know I asked that question of Mr. Enright, but actually the definition of utter means to offer a forged instrument. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it appears that I'm not sure that this can be charged separate as one continuing course.
Continuous. Well, I mean,
Well, your argument wasn't necessarily that it could be charged as one. You're just saying that it could merge.
Yeah, it seems like it could merge.
Upon a conviction of a theft of continuing course.
Yeah. And here we just use the word utter. So, and utter could also mean, I guess, alter, right? I think.
Well, what's your response to Mr. Enright's argument that yeah. by charging, it makes all the difference that these five counts, forgery counts, were charged, that limits the government's ability to then allege a continuing course of conduct for the purpose of theft? Do you agree with that? Disagree? And if you disagree, why?
I disagree that you know, the charging separate forgery accounts would limit our ability to aggregate for theft two or in ID theft two purposes.
Why do you disagree?
Because they're different crimes, they're different elements, and the appropriate time to consider not, you know, whether there's too many charges, sentencing, when you decide whether they merge, whether you should run the sentences concurrent, or so forth.
Well, I may agree with you about the charging. I'm not so sure I agree with you the sentencing. It seems to me the appropriate time would be for the jury when it determines whether or not there's a single course of conduct.
That's correct, yeah, whether there's a merger. That's a factual issue, whether there's a merger or not.
I mean, it may even be appropriate to instruct the jury that if they find a single course of conduct with respect to the thefts, then they would only consider either one count of the forgery or, as a matter of law, that you might even instruct them, mm-hmm. let them determine it, but then the court would merge the other counts just based on. In fact, there could be a separate factual interrogatory just to ask the jury whether they believe that the forgeries and the thefts were committed with one, you know, one impulse, one plan. Or
right.
Something.
And I think we're the reason why we're here on appeal is because ID theft 2 is a Class B felony.
Right.
I mean, that's what the defendant wants to avoid, is the Class B felony.
Right. And what the government wants to obtain is a Class B felony. The Class C felonies being insufficient.
Yeah.
And I realize, you know, in terms of that charge, it doesn't really seem to have been argued, but what personal information was conveyed here?
It's not in the complaint. It's not in the felony information.
Okay.
It just says personal information. And
yeah, so what personal information was actually conveyed here?
What would be the bank account number that's on the bottom of the check. There's a code, and down at the bottom has the bank number, the check number, the routing number.
Okay.
I might have misheard you. Did you say that theft in second degree is a Class B?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that a Class C?
ID theft.
ID theft's ID,
yeah.
But theft in the second degree is a Class C.
Yeah.
It's only the identity theft using the theft C theft second that gets into a Class
yeah,
B.
Yeah, the identity thefts is one grade up. Breach.
Right.
So, you know, third is a misdemeanor.
Anything
third,
less than 10,000 is a C. Is it Class C?
Theft one is 20,000, I think.
Is it 20 now?
It is. I guess it is now. Yeah.
Okay. Theft two, I think, 750.
750 now. It was 300.
And then theft three, maybe 100. And then theft four. So theft two is now a felony.
Okay. Okay, yeah, so
I think
the ID theft 3 has to be in a theft 3, I think.
2. The statute says theft 2.
Well, the ID theft 2 has to be a theft 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
if there's no theft 2, there's no ID theft 2nd, correct?
That's right.
Which is what we're talking about, right, because that has a higher sentence.
Yeah, so the theft 2 is a lesser included offense.
And if you don't aggregate, you don't get the theft 2nd, and if you don't get the theft 2nd, you don't get the ID.
That's correct.
Mr. Vincent, interested in getting your point of view in clarifying the point that you made in with respect to Justice Pollack's question about your position that a special interrogatory could be asked with respect to forgery that would have to do with whether there's a continuing course, so there could be a determination as to merger. If you consider the Decoit case again, where you've got what seems to be a decision as a matter of law that domestic violence cases are supposedly distinct, would you say that given your analysis that that would be, your analysis is inconsistent with the Decoit case in the sense that a jury ought to be able to determine?
Of course, we are.
I mean, determine Decoit. Whether it's a continuing course?
Yeah, our office argued in Decoit, or I don't know if it was our office, but the prosecution, the state argued that it could be charged as a continuous course of conduct. And I think we stick with that opinion, although we, you know, we obviously have to apply the law as it is decided.
What about the, is there an issue created by the fact that there was a guilty plea taken in this case on counts 1 through 5?
Yeah, it does complicate things, I guess, because now he's pled to all these five forgery counts and UPCPI count. So I don't know, in the interest of justice, what would have to, you know, whether, and in light of what your opinion may be, what would have to do.
It's only a problem if he's found guilty, right? Of a continuing course of conduct.
Right, Yeah, he admits, so I guess he concedes that he admits that he uttered these four checks on five different occasions for these amounts and so forth. He just doesn't think it should be aggregated.
Pretty well. Anything further at this time?
That's it.
I do have, I'm so sorry, and I realize that this really isn't something that's out there, but I just want to make sure I understand this charge of identity theft in the second degree. And it says, if the person directly or indirectly makes or causes a transmission of personal information by any oral statement, any written statement, or any statement conveyed by electronic means. So I'm just trying to understand what the statement here was. The statement is?
The transmission would be handing the check to the teller that had the, bank
number. Right. And the statement is the statement is the check?
Yeah, the written bank number on the check. By written form.
I see. So the check is the written statement that has the bank
check.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
It was accepted by the bank.
Well, thank you very much. I don't believe there are any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Vincent. Mr. Enright, any rebuttal? Very well. Thank you to our counsel for the arguments this morning. The court will take this matter under advice.